as we do every Sunday night for the last 35, 36 years since 1982. As you guys know, you've heard me say so often, the main purpose of the TechNet is education. We help each other learn more about wireless equipment in particular. But we discuss almost any subject of interest to ham radio operators. Lately, we're getting pretty heavy into physics, science, astro, in other words, astronomy type things. And so the way we run the net is there's three separate sections, so to speak. The first section is the people signing in with questions and or comments. The second section is the run by Roy, AC2GS, which we call physics and science. And the third section is Paul, WS2N, with the space report. And NASA's always launching new fantastic pieces of equipment that he's going to be telling us about. This is TechNet number 1,696, I think it is, yes. Paul will be giving us space report number 296, and Roy will be giving us science and physics report number 26. So do we have any check-ins at this time? Give me your call letters and name. Try to remember to wait for the four beeps, three beeps. K2I, I'll be listening.
KD2AMZ, yes.
Okay, that was a triple. That was a triple, but the one who won was KD2AMZ. AMZ, please tell me your name. I should tell, but tell me your name.
KD2AMZ, Mike, and yes, I have a question.
By the way, is that Alpha Mike Zulu or Alpha November Zulu?
Alpha Mike Zulu, Kilo Delta 2, Alpha Mike Zulu.
Very fine, very fine. We now have Mike. Who was the other person trying to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
And I suppose it's a yes.
No.
Yes.
Okay, that was another double. KE2EJ, Eric is the one who won. Who was the other person trying to sign in? Give me your call letters.
WA2RYY, Joe, yes. I have a transmitting window that excludes me from transmitting from 9 o'clock to 11 o'clock. So if you can't get me this week, you can get me next week.
Come ahead of me.
Okay, we got Joe, WA2RYY. So we got Mike, Eric, and Joe. Who is the other person trying to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Joe, KD2FIU, George, yes.
Okay, FIU, George, we got you. Who is the other person? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WB2GXM, Rich, and yes.
Okay, GXM, we got you. Is there another person trying to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, we got more than enough to keep going. Mike, KD2 Alpha Mike Zulu, go right ahead, Mike. K2LAW listening.
Thank you, Dick. My question has to do with television. I'm sure Eric can help out in this one. It has to do with the HDMI inputs into the TVs. I just bought a new TV. When I plug my DVD Blu-ray player into the TV, it doesn't play, no sound. It's like no sound. When I plug it into another HDMI input, it works perfectly. And then I went and got another DVD player because I thought it was no good. I plugged it into the, I thought was the same input. It works. So I thought all HDMI inputs were all the same. There's nothing to that. But apparently, like I said, my one HDMI input does not like my original DVD player, and that doesn't make any sense to me. Somebody can explain if there is a difference, and I think it's probably an Eric-type question. He would know off the top of his head. KD2AMZ.
KE2EJ. K2RIW. Go right ahead, Eric.
K2RIW. KE2EJ. There actually is a very reasonable explanation for that. HDMI, when it was created, it was HDMI 1.0. You know, you get dizzy talking about ATSC 3 as opposed to 1. We're now up to HDMI, what is it, 4.6 something. and S from the time HDMI was dreamed up, which was actually derived from something called DVI. It's an odd-looking plug. You'll find it on the back of a lot of computer monitors. You'll find on many monitors, you'll find two plugs, one that looks like a 15-pin VGA, which is a D connector, and a little longer rectangular thing, which looks like it has a little face on it. It's an interesting connector. Anyway, let me let it drop. The DVI connector started out as an analog thing, but eventually we went to digital and started using digital streams to pass the video. HDMI is actually an extension of what was created for DVI. Now, as time goes on, enter the picture 3D, enter the picture 4K. So, an old standard, which was designed for a particular bit rate, which would probably be, maybe 320 megabits per second, to going to a system of 4K, which is, I think it's 1.5 gigs, a little more than that. I'm not sure of the exact number. So there's different versions of HDMI. And let me know if you're dropping in. You may find on that set where it doesn't work is either, yeah, I think it's going to be the more advanced one that's designed for 4K. If it's a relatively new monitor and it does 3D or it does 4K, if it knows about it, then they'll specifically mark off that HDMI input. And if it's an earlier version of the set, whatever the protocol that the DVD player that doesn't work is, which is probably like HDMI 1.0, which a lot of modern-day receivers, because of the higher bit rates, they tend not to recognize the old one, but usually they'll put one or two on a set that knows the whole set. So, there you go. K2IW, K2J.
Okay, you've discussed the source of the incompatibility. Is there anything he can do to make his particular combination not work, or is his fate sealed by the fact that the standards have changed? Over to you, Eric.
Well, from what I heard, is he plugged it into a different port on the same set and it worked fine, which makes total sense. There's also something invented in the college, CDP, or HTTP. Yeah, HTTP, thank you. It's a form of digital encryption. It was being developed at the time the original standard was being created, so it makes it so that if you have copyrighted content, it tells any HDMI device, and I mean any HDMI device, built into the chip. That's one of the things about HDMI. It's built into the chip. The chip has an algorithm that says, I'm a receiver, and those chips only sold to receiver manufacturers. Okay, so if you're sending a DVD that's a commercial DVD that's encrypted, and that's content that needs to be protected. Let me drop it again. The signal that the DVD player puts out HDMI with the HDCP flag zone, which means that the TV set has to send a key back to the DVD player before the DVD player will let the video pass on to the monitor. Because there are devices that, like your laptop, you can plug your HDMI into the laptop, or some of them, with the appropriate program. When you hit record, you record the content. If it's protected, and that's actually built into the HTTP of the laptop, it will tell you that this is protected stuff and you can't record it. So, you know, it's a little more than meets the eye. It's a rather little complex system. Actually, the handshaking that goes on in itself is an interesting thing, and the organization that provides the licenses is somewhat secretive about it. So, K2IW, K3J.
Okay, I thank you. Good information. Let's see if Mike has any follow-up questions or needs any drills. KD2AMZ, K2IW. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, thank you.
thank you, Eric, and thank you, Dick. Eric, you answered my questions, because when I plugged it into a different port, it started working just fine. And I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense, because it was an older DVD player a few years ago. This is a brand new TV, 4K. It's only about a week or two old. So, and when I plugged it into a different port, it made sense. It worked. So what you described to me actually makes a lot of sense, and now I know what I need to do. Just got to, when it doesn't work 100% correctly, use a different port, and it solves the problem. So I went out and bought a DVD player where I probably didn't have to, but now I got two of them, so I'll put it in my bedroom TV now. So it's not the end of the world, but it's something people should be aware of. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Dick. KD2AMZ.
I have a question for you. Do you mind, Nick?
You got it.
So here's a man who went out and bought a 4K monitor, TV set. I have a question for you. You bought a DVD player. Why did you... It doesn't sound like you bought a 4K DVD player. Or a 4K Blu-ray player. Or at least even a, a Blu-ray player. Take full advantage of the TV set that you got. You bought a 4K set. Was it just the price, or was there some other reason behind it?
There was a couple of the reasons, Eric, why I bought it. My older TV was heating up my shack where it was getting hot. It was, running warmer. The new monitor runs on the LEDs, which is much, much cooler to operate. And, yes, it is a Blu-ray player, so I was able to get more or less the full benefit out of both of them. And the price of the new Blu-ray DVD player was really quite cheap. It was only like $59 on sale. So I didn't lose anything, but yes, that is why I did it. But, I hope that answers your question, Eric.
I want to go a step further. Do you get cable, satellite, Fios, DirecTV, DishNet, any of those things?
Yeah, I get Fios and over the air, and I don't think anybody's broadcasting 4K yet. But when I go to, Netflix, I have a Roku player, and it also gets Netflix direct on the TV. That supposedly has 4K programming.
All right, well, let me tell you that Fios, DirecTV, EchoStar, or, DishNet, and K-Movies, and all have 4K streams. So, if you're interested in it, you can call them up and say, get me the box that plays 4K. Also, there is actually quite a bit of content out there. That's why I suggested a Blu-ray player that was 4K, because more and more now, more movies are winding up on 4K. So, as long as you went to the expense of buying a nice set that really doesn't give you much in terms of your eyeball, because you probably didn't get close to it. But there's a lot of stuff out there that you can use to plug into it and watch some very pretty pictures. All right, that's it.
Final comment for Eric?
Go ahead.
Yes, Eric, I understand everything you're saying, but my primary reason for buying a set, because, yes, I am way too close to it, was because of the heat. It was really warming up my shack. I had to move from my basement shack into my old daughter's bedroom, which is tiny, tiny. It's like an attic room, and it gets very hot up here, and the TV was just generating a lot of heat, and it just got hot in here, so I said, enough, I gotta get something that runs cooler, and that was my primary reason, was it was getting hot.
All right, well, that's gotta be a tiny little room, because, even the old sets, the clunkers were barely 300 watts, so, if you wanna calculate that in BTUs, you're welcome to it, not that much, but. All right, well, anyway, you got more modern technology that isn't necessarily going to break. It doesn't break in the next 90 days. It ain't going to break, so you're doing fine.
Okay, Eric, again, thank you again very much. You've answered all my questions, and let's go back to net control.
Eric, you said that, I think you're talking about a CRT-type TV set. I think you're saying they run around 350 watts. The modern-day, let's say, a 40-inch... flat screen TV. What kind of wattage are they running? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, All right, well, I took a clue is that it was an old set, and he said LEDs, but, you know, this plasma is 400 or 500 watts, but the first LED back panel displays, because most people don't realize it, well, it's LED set, that's what the illumination is LED, but it's still a liquid crystal in front of it, so, but the newer sets where the actual dots are LEDs is what he's got now. They draw barely
75 watts, if that much.
I should know, my Vizio set bought a couple of years ago. What's your guess, a 40-inch, what's your guess as to the kind of display I've gotten, where the illumination is coming from? Is there a, what do they call it now? A compact fluorescent light giving the green, the general illumination behind the display? Over to you, Eric.
Well, it's kind of an easy way to answer that question. You know, how old is it? That's the very thing. But if you look in your menu and you have a knob that lets you control the brightness of the background, not the brightness control, but there's another one that says backlight brightness, so it's something that's different than just brightness. If you got one of those, you got an LED. You got a huge rows of LEDs, a matrix of LEDs in the back, and a piece of what essentially looks like opal glass to diffuse it so there's no even illumination. And then you have a thin film liquid crystal display, and then a polarizer in front of it. And as you said, do 3D. That's another clue.
Approximately 2 years ago, no 3D, and whether or not I've got that brightness, background brightness control, I'll have to go look and find out. Before we turn it over to you for your question, tonight I presume we've got IRLP, we've got Echo Link, chat room, all the things working tonight. Eric, go ahead, K2LIW.
Well, as far as I know, actually I'm sitting at the gate just at the station. I usually have checked that before, but we started coughing, so I haven't even passed into the place. But I can look on my phone. I'm pretty sure everything's going, but I can double check.
Go right ahead with your question, Eric.
No, I'm going to make this fast, because Joe's waiting in the wings there. Joe, don't go away. It'll only be a minute. It's actually a follow-up on what we were talking about last week in terms of FM antennas. I haven't been able to find an engineering organization that operates a drone to do an antenna pattern measurement. That isn't a million miles away, and that doesn't cost as much as a freaking helicopter service, so I decided I was going to take the antenna that I have and mount it a quarter wave away from a pole, a very specific pole, and try to create a cardioid pattern out of it. And position it in the right place, and hopefully that'll do the job.
I would guess a quarter wave again, away from a pole, as far as the vertical polarization is concerned, maybe even the horizontal if the pole is big enough, is going to give you emphasis in that direction where you're a quarter wave away, and then a bit of a null in the other direction, through the pole, so to speak. Is that what you're trying for, and have you done it? And any tested results yet, Eric? Go ahead.
I haven't done it yet. I want to draw it out, plot it out, and talk to a few, talk to the guy who designed the antenna. And, I mean, the pole is essentially the leg of the tower. You know, but I have to mount it in a very specific way. And really, I'm looking for, like, if I could just get maybe 3 dB less in the null part of the pattern, I think I can get away with what I need to do. So, you gotta remember, I'm doing this for a Beg-Me station, which is, by the way, a very interesting station. Very weird at times and very eclectic. And even to do anything on top of 4th Times Square, we're talking at least an $8,000 bill just to get people up there, let alone do something. So, you know, I gotta try and make the right decision and do it as cheaply as possible.
Have you ever looked a couple of weeks at the newer station 11-4. They've got some pretty unusual programming, but that's probably not what you're discussing right now. Is that true?
Oh, that's the whole nether world what you're talking about. No, we're talking about broadcast FM radio. It's basically old people that haven't grown up, if you want to think of it that way. They play a little bit of everything. We got one guy who's on for an hour. He plays various different forms of noise. I was working on the transmitter one day. I thought something was going on in the audio circuit. It was just a junction they were playing.
You're telling me that one man's music is another man's noise, or vice versa? Okay. Any further information you'd like to give us or ask us or whatever tonight, Eric? KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer from the New York City area, K2IZ. Have you got Eric?
No, I just wanted to fill you in on what was going on. Go ahead, give it to Joe before he runs away.
Yeah, Joe's got 37 minutes before he runs out on his string. W2LYY, K2IZ, you go ahead, Joe.
Okay, good evening, Dick. How you doing? This is an antenna question for you. We've all heard that phrase in the past that's been said many, many times. You resonate, then you have the ability to radiate. That's great. You've spoke about many ways of resonating an antenna by using an antenna tuner or other various means of tuning and so forth. What do you do about the counterpoise, or I should say, lack of counterpoise? Give you a more specific example. Using HF on a motor vehicle or using HF in a plane, your counterpoise really isn't very big to begin with. Over to you.
Okay. The word counterpoise can sometimes be misunderstood in the word ground. There are people who think you got to have a good RF ground, you got to have a counterpoise. You only need a counterpoise if your radiating system is a monopole and not a dipole. In the case of a dipole, assume that an astronaut is floating in free space, he's a mile behind the space shuttle in his spacesuit, and in front of him is a dipole. You could say that the dipole antenna, a thoroughly balanced structure, at one instant of time, the right-hand side is positive, left-hand side is negative, and current is flowing from left to right. And the next half cycle, current is flowing from right to left between the two halves of the dipole. A dipole antenna is its own counterpoise. So if you're radiating with a balanced radiating system, you don't need a counterpoise. Now, the word counterpoise, in some cases, people think that the reflector, which has some effect on the impedance and quite a bit of an effect on the radiating pattern. That's not necessarily a counterpoise. So only if your antenna is electronically a half wave, it almost needs no counterpoise because the feed impedance is so damn high if you're feeding the outer end. So lots of antennas require no counterpoise and radiate like a banshee. Is that a little bit clearer, Eric? I mean, that Joe. W2LYY, K2LYW.
Maybe somewhat. I was talking to... you can't put a dipole on a truck. I forget the exact name of the antenna that I've heard people putting on either trucks or automobiles that use a remote tuner to get the thing to resonate. But what become, in a case like that, that's half of your dipole or half of your antenna assembly. So the other half, I guess, has to be your truck body, or if you're putting in small aircraft, it has to be the rest of the aircraft as far as metal to act as somewhat of a counterpoise. What if that really isn't long enough? Doesn't that affect the basic overall efficiency of the antenna system? Back to you.
Yeah, the antenna you were trying to think of the name of might be the so-called screwdriver antenna, which has got a great big loading coil at the bottom, which is remotely tunable with a screwdriver motor, so to speak. So you remotely run that motor clockwise or counterclockwise, and you're using more or less of the loading coil at the bottom. If the radiating system is electronically a half wave, and you're feeding the outer edge, or you're feeding a very high impedance, you need very little counterpoise. Even if It's a completely floating transmitting system because it's an automobile or a truck. And it's not connected to Earth and it's got no power cable going to a mains heating system. It's a thoroughly isolated system, RF-wise. The fact that the counterpoise, the automobile, is too small doesn't matter. Even if you're using a quarter wave radiator, then what you've got to do to make that system resonate is going to be a little bit different. Your quarter wave resonator, if you're doing nothing but changing its length, you'll find out it operates a little bit different than quarter wave. And by the way, a quarter wave versus a half wave resonator, I'm talking about its electronic length, not its physical length. There's a hell of a lot of radiators that are less than a quarter wave length long physically, but because they've got the loading coils and zigzag and helical winding and top hat and bottom hat capacitors and so on, they are electronically half wave. Now, if, for instance, you didn't do all of these things I'm now mentioning, let me drop a call. You truly have a quarter wave or less than a quarter wave for the radiator, and you've got a vehicle that's a 20th of a wavelength in size, and that's the so-called counterpoise. And this whip-like antenna is working between between the automobile body and that less than quarter wavelength long radiator. And you've got an antenna tuner, and the antenna tuner forces the whole thing into resonance. You would think under those conditions you've got a very low efficiency system. We've got to be careful now about the word efficiency. Except for the fact that the earth around you is sucking up some of that RF, and that earth that you're driving over is a volumetric resistive material. And so the RF that goes into it, an awful lot of it gets absorbed and turned into heat. And the only way you can control that is by the pattern of your antenna. As the antenna gets taller, and the phase center is further above the earth, the amount of earth absorption becomes less. You get more what you and I would call efficiency. But when my main definition of efficiency here, let me drop it. My definition of efficiency from an antenna point of view is how many watts of RF energy am I putting into the antenna? How many watts is being radiated, and how many watts is being turned into heat? Of all the power you apply to an antenna, there's only three things the antenna can do. Reflect some of it, and maybe your antenna tuner takes care of that and reflects it forward. Radiate an awful lot of it, that's what you desire. Or, because the antenna contains lossy or resistive materials, a not-so-great tuning capacitor, or a loading coil that's made out of a very thin-gauge wire, and so on. So it's turning some of the RF energy into heat. If your radiating system runs ice cold to the touch, you put 100 watts into it, you do it for a few minutes, turn it off, and touch everything. If everything's ice cold, in theory, you've got near 100% efficiency from my point of view. The RF energy you're putting into it, very little of it is being sent back to the transmitter because of the antenna tuner. Very little of it's being converted into heat because it's running ice cold. Therefore, there's nothing left other than the fact that it is radiating into space. So that's my first step of definition of radiating efficiency. Is the system radiating the signal into space? The second step now is going to be how much is the local earth absorbing and turning into heat, which you have very little control over. So a hell of a lot of antennas. Let me drop this. A hell of a lot of antennas are physically very small, like a rubber duck antenna. I cringe a little bit when I hear a person say, oh, I'm running a rubber duck antenna, I'm probably getting 10% efficiency. Oh, really? If that handy talkie of yours is putting 5 watts for the next 2 minutes that you key down, 5 watts into that rubber duck, and if the rubber duck runs ice cold, and the outer metal case of your handy talkie is not made out of carbon granules, it's a really conductive material. You gotta be careful now. The case may be getting hot because the heat dissipated by the final stage transistor that's doing the transmitting. But if the case is running cold and the rubber duck is running cold, you've got a near 100% efficiency system. And if it's resonating correctly, that rubber duck can be a very efficient antenna. In the old days, rubber duck antennas had a nichrome piece of wire in there because it gave them a better broadband impedance match. Yes, that one was low in efficiency. They don't build them that way anymore. So a whole hell of a lot of the so-called inefficient antennas really are efficient from my point of view, Eric. A joke. That's the second time tonight. W-H-R-I-Y, K-2-R-I-W. Great joke.
HF radio in an aircraft. I was talking to a pilot friend of mine, and he had the radio set up in his aircraft. He uses a long wire. What do they call it? A king long wire with an antenna tuner. So it's strung between the top of the rudder and part of the fuselage. And then that beep comes inside, goes to his antenna tuner, then goes to his HF radio. What I did notice with that setup, I think we were talking on, what was it, like 40 meters. I think the flight is 540 meters using SSB. I had a certain signal level when he was on the runway, getting ready to take off, and I noticed that after he took off, talking the same average amount of voice power into the microphone from listening to him, his signal level started to decrease quite rapidly. And I thought, well, as it gets higher, he's got more line of sight to me. It didn't seem to be that case at all on HF. As he got higher and went further away, the signal got much, much weaker, much quicker than when he was actually on the ground. That's why he asked about the other half, the atomic counterpoise. I guess when a vehicle is on the ground, can part of the ground or be part of your counterpoise? And with an aircraft... Got me there. And with an aircraft, as it actually gets up in the air, it only has itself as it to be part of a counterpoise.
The nearby Earth under his airplane when he's sitting on the runway, on an HF antenna of the kind that you described, is going to change the tuning of the antenna somewhat. And yes, the capacitive loading between the aircraft and the ground at HF frequencies, it's a minor effect on the tuning. When he's up in the air and he no longer has that Earth nearby, if his antenna tuner is automatic and if he's rechecked and if he's getting reasonable, impedance match between the transmitter, antenna tuner, and that antenna, he is still radiating the same amount of signal, in my opinion. Now, as he gets up in the air, the airplane is flying in some other direction. That antenna he's using is quite directional. And so, depending on which way it aimed and where you are with relation to it, is going to be a bigger factor as to what you're seeing as far as signal strength is concerned. On top of that, when he was on the runway, maybe the signal was getting to you by near vertical incident skywave, NEVIS. So my first question was going to be, how many miles was there between you and his aircraft on the runway? And when he did take off, was the airplane aimed in some other direction? If he could fly a circle with the airplane after he took off, that would be interesting to see what signal strength you saw. On top of that, depending on what band you're on, and the way the propagation of that day works, 40 meters is one of these. Let me drop it. I think somebody wants to give us a comment. There are times when on HF, for the certain number of miles between you and the signal and the guy, as he raises the altitude of the radiating system, you get a weaker signal because of skip zone-like problems. Who's the person who wanted to give us some comments? Give me your full call letters and name, and then proceed. K2RIW.
Yes, good evening, Dick. It's Hank in 1YDY. And in my experience in airplanes that had HF that were usable on amateur frequencies, and there were a few that were still around as little as 15 years ago, you could very much count on the airplane being very directional. The airplane I flew that had an HF had a fiberglass tail cone that had an antenna embedded into it and then used the rest of the fuselage as the counterpoise. And it was extremely directional, number one. And the other comment I wanted to add to that was that the ground, if you're operating on the ground, the type of surface you're over had a lot to do with how well you got out. When we were in Boston, I was able to talk a lot further than I was in most of the mid-continent airports that I flew in and out of. Specifically, Detroit was the one that I can make a direct comparison to at the moment. I can remember the direct comparison at the moment. In Boston, of course, being built over an ocean with the water, it had a more of a reflective element to its signal. I don't know how that actually works mathematically, but it was certainly something you could count on empirically in 1YDY.
Yeah, thank you, Hank. Good information. So, I'm guessing the antenna directional pattern is a major effect. exact number of feet between the aircraft and the Earth is a rather minor one, in my opinion, Joe. So it sure would have been nice if you could have flown a circular pattern. But even the circular pattern would be a little bit difficult to judge, because as he flies the circle, the airplane is tilted at a 30-degree angle, his banking turn, if you know what I mean, and that changes the antenna pattern. But still, flying in a general circle would take the antenna pattern effect away. And I think antenna pattern, which is one of the first things that Hank mentioned, I think that's the major effect you were seeing. Sitting on the runway, he may have been aimed to the north, but when he was really flying, he was flying to the east. The B2LYY, K2LAW, good question. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, the antenna is a long wire, so it's a piece of wire attached, as I said again, from the top of the runner to a point on the fuselage just behind where the pilot sits. So it's like that long. It's about maybe 15, 18 feet of wire. Because he's running a flying a twin engine aircraft. Yeah, I think you know how long those things are. He took off out of Republic. Republic, for me, is probably 15, 18 miles away in line of sight. He was heading west, but I also had him, when he could, because he was flying VFR at the time, change his direction about 40 degrees. In the direction he purposely did a zigzag, and I really didn't notice much of any difference at all. I thought of that, if he's heading away from me, it's almost like I'm at the end of the dipole and listening to a signal. But as he turned 45 degrees one way than the other way, it really didn't change the apparent level of signal that I heard. It just seemed to be increasingly weaker and weaker and weaker the higher he went.
But okay, somebody else wants to give us a comment. Who was that?
K2RIW, KD2FIU, hello. Dick, George here. I believe the question started with a King antenna. And if that was a QSO King antenna, it's a 9-to-1 balance. And we've got to start with the thinking about that. Did you say King antenna?
I believe that's what he called it. I think he called it King long wire, King antenna King long wire with an antenna to it. Maybe it's a complete package that allows you to operate HF out of the aircraft.
If it's called QSO King, which is a product, it going to require a very wide range tuner, either at the antenna or at the radio, and of course wider range if it's at the radio, including the coax. And they work more optimum above 51 feet, best 88 feet and above in length of wire. So it may be the fact that if he was below, say, 26 feet in length of wire, he would need an extremely high-quality long-range tuner to keep him going on the air with a 9-to-1 balun, which I understand you opened up with saying by King antenna, which is a 9-to-1.
I can find out more specifics next time I talk. Maybe I'll bring it back up next week and I'll find more specifics about it. But I believe the length of the antenna is only about 18 feet long, because this plane is a twin-engine plane, and it's definitely not 51 feet long from tail to, tip to tail. So the wire is definitely not anywhere near that. I believe it's about 18 feet in length, total length of the wire itself.
82FIU. Yes, so, and they work down to about 26 feet with much wider range tuners. So the problem may be also the range of his tuner to bring it even below what that 9-to-1 is. And it's a very specific product. I've read about that in the past. I don't know if this helps, KD2FIU.
Hi, George. What you're describing now is the impedance match, the 9-to-1 between the transmitter, antenna tuner, and that antenna. fucked up. If that system, if the transmitter is not tripping out because it's seeing high vis, well, then in theory his antenna has enough, antenna tuner has enough range. And I'm guessing that although the antenna may be a difficult thing to resonate in that manner, I don't think there's going to be a significant difference in that resonance when the aircraft is on the runway versus up in the air. So, and assuming his antenna tuner didn't suddenly run out of range because he took off, this might not be the factor. I think antenna pattern is a bigger factor. So, I guess you're going to be gathering a little bit more information on this thing as time goes on, Joe. The so-called infinitesimal dipole can have 100% radiation efficiency. It may be very high in Q, very narrow band in its tuning. Your Q is Y, 20 KC, and you got to readjust the antenna tuner. But everyone assumes that an antenna that's a small number of wavelengths long is going to be inefficient. Not at all. It may be very difficult to impedance match, but once you accomplish that impedance match with good hardware, you should be radiating more than 90% of the signal. Open you for any further comments, Joe, to B2RYY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, I'll find out more about it next week. Maybe I'll bring it up again. From what I understand, what they do on commercial aircraft, like jetliners and so forth, the antenna where it trails out of the either the back of the plane directly, depending on the construction of the back or the top of the rudder, the top of the tail above the, where the rudder would be moving, and they can change the length of that for tuning, because I know HF, they use HF like down as low as like 5598 kilohertz for some overseas traffic. When they get like 200, 300 miles offshore, they can't talk and be a chef anymore. They're out of range. But I'll find out what specifically what he's using as far as the antenna product, the antenna tuner, and so forth. I mean, tomorrow I clear. I'm enlisting. Over the next guy.
And when it comes to wavelength considerations, and they're radiating for long-range communication to an aircraft at frequencies below 1 megacycle, with the antennas on board, no matter what that antenna is, if it's not a half mile of trailing wire as an infrared zip out of the back of the airplane, which it's not, only Zeppelins do that, then once again you've got an antenna that's a very small fraction of a wavelength in length, and yet that can be an efficient radiator as long as you've got the right tuning mechanism connected to it. So there's a lot of misunderstanding of fractional wavelength antennas and efficiency. The pattern may be something you don't have much control over, and maybe you don't like the pattern you're going to get out of that infinitesimal antenna because of its physical orientation. But it doesn't necessarily have to be inefficient because it's small. Small antennas can be efficient. George is the next guy. WA2, I think it is. FIU. Maybe it's KD2. I'm not sure of your prefix, George. Mr. FIU. K2IW. You got it, George.
Thank you, Dick. KD2, FIU. Question is around common mode return 50-ohm coaxial cable with ground-mounted vertical antennas. Let's say they are resonant, ground-mounted, either single-band or multi-band, and we're ground-mounted spiked, and whether we need radials for tuning any of the bands is not the issue, and basically it's going to be about common mode return currents. Let me let it drop. If we're working a ground-mounted radio, HF, 10 through 80, whether it's single or multi, and we have high-quality coax running along good ground, good earth that is giving us nice resistance, low resistance to the station ground. To control common mode, do we need to apply the common mode elements, whether it's ferrites or windings and specific windings of coaxial, high-quality coaxial cable, do we need to apply that since we're running the cable either on the ground, 1 inch, 2 inch, 4 inches below the ground? Does the cable being run on the ground assist in controlling common mode return?
That good earth that you're talking about, maybe you live over a swampland, definitely helps, but in some cases it's not enough. If I'm running a quarter wave length radiator, or less than quarter wave length radiator, which might have a base impedance, the resistive component might be 15 ohms, and if my grounding system, I don't have a good counterpoise, I've got nothing but a spike in the ground, and it has a resistance also of 15 ohms, you can see how even if everything is working correctly, 15 ohms of grounding resistance local to the antenna and 15 ohms of radiation resistance of the antenna is such that half of your voltage is going into the earth. So anything you can do to make the radiator an end-fed, electronically half-wavelength, which starts getting you into the 1,000 and 2,000 ohms of radiation resistance, now a very simple grounding system can work very well near the antenna. Other than that, the current that can flow along that cable, no matter where that cable is mounted, can be significant. It can give you RF in the shack. The current flowing on the cable is giving you some other antenna pattern. That antenna pattern is heavily coupled to earth itself, which is a volumetric resistive absorber of RF energy that turns it into heat. Let me drop it. So that, in general, current flowing, common mode current flowing on the outside of your coax is pretty much undesirable. It can give you, at certain bands, RF in the shack that's not good, feedback, hot microphone, inefficiency, crazy antenna pattern, and so on. And now, eliminating that is fairly easy. Making sure the antenna is a half-wave resonator fed at the end where the impedance is very high, that goes a long way to eliminating the problem. Half-wavelength electronically radiating system. The next step after that is to try to eliminate the current. And the quickest and dirtiest way to doing that is a poor man's balance. The right number of turns of coax as a coil, whether that coil is laying on the ground or whatever, almost doesn't matter. You can calculate from the antenna, from either the antenna manual or the radio amateur's handbook, how many feet diameter of coil with how many turns is how many ohms of inductive reactance at that particular band. And once that inductive reactance is a high enough number, you get very little current flowing down that cable. And you could do it with more compact systems by chunks of ferrite on the coax, but the easiest way of doing it, as I see it, is a poor man's balance. So there are various ways you can make sure there is no current flowing, no substantial current flowing on that cable. And to depend on the earth, because you're burying the cable in the earth to eliminate it, that's a long shot. I wouldn't depend on that. That's my opinion on this one, as I see it. George, having trouble reading my handwriting. KD2FIU, K2LIW. Eliminating it's not so difficult. George, go ahead.
Okay, Dick, we're on the same page with that. Very good, because, I could visualize what you were just saying. And the earth, which is part of my circuit at that point, is not going to be part of my balun. So let's say I got to work with conventional balun designs, even if I'm going to lay them in front of the antenna on the earth. Thank you, Dick. KD2FIU, and I'll turn it over.
Yeah, with various kinds of baluning devices, at the base of the antenna, you can make the coax input impedance any number you want. That may not be good enough, because the antenna itself has a lot of current flowing back and forth in the radiating portion of it, and that current is being launched into the antenna with reference to the local earth. If the place where you're launching that current into the radiating system is a very high impedance, it's a half wavelength electronic, and you're feeding the outer edge of it, where it's a 2,000 ohm impedance, well, then you can't make a ground system that's poor compared to 2,000 ohms, if you know what I mean. If it's got 200 ohms of resistance, which is a really lousy ground, of earth resistance, 2,000 ohms, 200 ohms, and the antenna was 2,000. You can see that the vast majority of the current is going into the antenna, and only a small percentage is going into the earth. So no matter how you impedance match from that point, doesn't change it. So shoot for half wavelength radiators if you have the choice, end-fed, and beyond that, to be double dot sure, I would put the poor man's balun, the coil of the right number of turns of the right diameter, giving you a high enough inductive reactance so that there is no ability for common mode current to flow on the outside of the coax between the antenna and the shack. Try to eliminate that, because almost never is it beneficial. It's almost always going to give you grief on some band at some particular frequency at some time, and current flowing on that cable on the outside, it ain't your friend, so try to eliminate it. Next person on our list was Rich, WB2GXM. I think it's Golf X-Ray Mike. You've got it, Rich. K2LIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Thank you, Dick. This is Rich, K2RIW, WB2GXM. My coworker suffered a heart attack Friday. He's all right, but he now has a pacemaker. Now, my question is, if he visits me and sits down next to me in my shack in front of my 100-watt transmitter, HF only, and I have a common mode choke on my antenna feed, is he putting himself in jeopardy? K2RW, WB2GXM.
I'm not perfectly sure, but reasonably sure the answer is not a problem. As long as you don't have hot RF in the shack, a whole lot of it, and even the modern-day pacemakers, the manufacturers have realized a long time ago that if electromagnetic interference is going to interfere with the operation of the pacemaker, it's something they've got to really control. So the design of the pacemaker is an extremely well-shielded system nowadays. So, whether or not his pacemaker was being affected, I can think of various ways where you could run a test where he would know, so to speak. Is it 100% safe? No. But I think it's 98% safe, if you know what I mean, because of the design of the pacemaker and because your system, your HF system is designed in such a way that you don't have a whole lot of current flowing on the outside of that cable. There's ways you can monitor how much current is flowing on the outside of the transmission line. I'm assuming your transmitter and the antenna tuner are themselves well shielded. So the only way that RF energy could be in the shack is that either the antenna is only 5 feet away, which is not your environment. Let me drop. Most likely the antenna is 50 feet away in the backyard, so that's not a problem. Whether or not you get a whole lot of current flowing in your coax cable is about the only way you can have a lot of RF energy in the shack that potentially could give the pacemaker some grief. So I think it's 98% safe, in my opinion. But having your buddy sit there while you're transmitting, and whether or not he will be able to feel the pacemaker doing something funny, giving him the equivalent of a palpitation, so to speak, is another clue. So have him monitor his body very carefully during your first couple of transmissions. Other than that, I think you're reasonably safe, Rich. Got the B2GXM, K2IW. Drag your feet in case we got somebody here with good medical knowledge that can give me an update. So, Rich, to take it with a delay, K2IW, the TechNet.
ACCF, yeah.
Go right ahead, Roy. And there's the man with the medical knowledge. You got it, Roy. And by the way, do the pacemaker manufacturers make specific recommendations along these lines? And your audio is a little bit low, and I know why you're doing that. You might not have to. Go right ahead, Roy.
Okay, I revved it up a little bit. Tell me if I drop off this again. The manufacturer and the doctors who placed it are probably the best guys to ask about this. In a shack, unless it's a very poorly designed shack, it's very dubious whether there's any risk. I wouldn't have him climb your tower while you're transmitting, though, but I doubt that you were planning on doing that.
The literature that comes with the pacemaker, does the manufacturer give any words along these lines, as I see it, Roy? Over to you.
Well, it depends upon how much literature they give the individual. You could always go to the website, look up the model, because there's a lot of different models, and they operate in different ways. There are demand pacemakers and non-demand pacemakers, and they all work slightly different. There's lots of proportions. Once again, I would talk to the cardiologist who will place the pacemaker. I would get out the little card that people get with the pacemaker that gives the model number, and do a search on the website and look up all the specifics. Usually that's the best recommendation for that situation. But as I said before, I don't know of any pacemaker days that's sensitive that inside a reasonably designed shack is going to give you a problem. Very high RF energy of powers, yeah, it's possible, but not really shack.
I thank you, Roy. And Roy, as you know, you've occasionally had a fraction of a second of dropout, and you thought it was related to audio. I think it's not. I hear it once in a while. And by the way, we don't lose any of your words. Don't worry. It's just a slightly annoying situation. But there are times when there's a pause in your speech and the dropout occurs. I think it's got something to do with the particular voting system input that's operational in your neighborhood. And as soon as we get to Eric's ear again, I'm going to ask him about that. So, doesn't sound like there's much of a problem, Rich, and I think there's various ways that you can read up on that particular manual. One quick question I've got for you, Roy. If the pacemaker was giving some kind of an erratic operation because of RF, can you think of any way that the patient would know what symptom to look for, like the operation of his heart feels different, so to speak? Is there anything that the patient can look for that would give him a clue? AC2GS, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, the pacemaker would primarily just stop pacing, and so whatever arrhythmia, you know, non-rhythmic heartbeat that you have without the pacemaker would reestablish itself, and you feel palpitations, irregular heartbeat, you might feel lightheaded, dizzy, and all the things that caused you to need the pacemaker in the first place.
I thank you, Roy. Back to you, Rich. WP2GXM, K2RIW. And let us know what you find out on this one now, as you do further testing, Rich.
Thank you, Dick, and thank you, Roy. This is very scary stuff, and it hit very close to home this time. So, everyone out there, take care of your bodies, please. K2RIW in the group, WB2GXM, clear.
We're, so to speak, right on schedule tonight. In other words, in the old days, we used to try to make the first section 1 hour long. I think we've gone down the list of people who signed in with questions or comments. Let me double check to make sure I haven't missed somebody. K2RIW listening.
2RIW, KC2NKQ.
Okay, Mr. NKQ, start up with your name and your question or comment.
Hey, the name here is Tom. Yes, I work on large commercial airplanes. Just point of information. The way the HS is set up in some of the older airplanes, your transmitter is down in your lower E&E, which is in the fuselage, then there's a coupler mounted out at the end of the wing, and then you have, if you look at an older 747, you'll see there's like a bit of a boom sticking out of the end, each wingtip. That's the antenna. Each one is an antenna for each HF. The trend now is to go with the leading edge of the vertical stabilizer. The couplers and the splitter are mounted up there, and you know, they're a pain in the neck to change sometimes.
And those antennas you're describing right now, describe each one of those antennas and what frequency region are they being used on, Tom? Go ahead.
Okay, it's basically that Collins unit covers up to about 26 meg, and the antenna itself, it's basically, it's just an aluminum tube that's mounted in there with a lightning arrestor that goes in there. It looks like a transmitting tube almost. And that's essentially...